Good evening, everybody. Thank you for coming. Glad that you could be here. My name is Mel Lorenz, and this event is just kind of a standalone thing, something that we thought that we would try. We're going to be asking you and other people what are the hot topics, what are the hot questions that people have today. But we thought that here in the month of April, because of the extreme importance of the time leading up to Easter, there are important issues on our minds. Next time, a week from Thursday on the 14th of April, our topic will be, what difference do the death and resurrection of Jesus make today? And unlike what we do in sermons and that kind of thing, this will be more of a teaching session and more angled at what is sometimes called apologetics, which doesn't mean apologizing. It means how do you defend the things that are believed in the faith, and how do you answer some of the big questions that come up? And one of the biggest questions that comes up is how many different ways are there to God? I remember years ago when my daughter was just starting college, I said to her, what are the really big spiritual or religious issues that you face and that you hear from your friends today? And she said, oh, that's easy. By far and away, more than anything else, the question that people want to have an answer for is, if there is one way to God, what do you do with all of the other religions of the world, all of the other well-meaning attempts to help people find transcendent meaning in their life? And if Christians, for instance, say there is only one way to God, is that rather belligerent or even mean-spirited to other people? And that's a question that I've heard many, many times over, and it's a fair question, and it deserves a good answer. So we're going to plunge into that, take it apart bit by bit, and after my presentation, we'll have a time of question and answer. So be thinking about questions that you have, the most difficult questions you can possibly think of. Maybe I'll regret saying that. And also, we're going to be joined by a special guest who's going to be a part of the Q&A time there as well. But let's start here. How many ways are there to God? Do all paths lead to the same place? You're a university student, and you make your way to one class where the professor says that everybody knows that since the Enlightenment in European history, we have known that human beings and Western civilization has grown beyond the need for superstitions like religion, has grown beyond any sense that there is a transcendent being or a God. And we just know that. The university student then goes to his or her next class, a class on sociology, and learns that there are easy ways to explain all of the different phenomena of religion in the world. And there isn't anything supernatural about it, isn't anything particularly mysterious about it. It's just the way people react when, for instance, they're afraid of death and need to have some hope beyond death. Then the student goes to another class and learns about some of the native religions of the world, some of the religions coming out of Africa and so on, and learns that the professor is not only an expert in these things, but he is also a voodoo priest. Entirely different scenario. A pastor holds a can of kerosene and spills it over a book while his associate lights it, and somebody stands to the side, handful of people watching as they burn the Quran. And in Afghanistan, some days later, you're a simple villager and you don't know what's going on out in the streets, but there's some kind of a mob gathering and there's some guy kind of leading it, seeming to incite people. And so you go along with the crowd and you walk down the road, and what you hear along the way is shocking. It's stunning that you hear the news that in America, the Quran is systematically being burned and in other ways desecrated. And you watch the mob get out of hand, and you watch it set upon an outpost and some people being killed. Another scenario, you're an atheist. Not only that, you're an evangelistic atheist. You're an atheist who is bound and determined to convince other people that there is no God. You're so passionate about it, you speak about it at every opportunity. And then one day you hear from the doctor that you have cancer, esophageal cancer. a dire prognosis. And you get letters, because you're well known, letters from Christians, some of who are saying the judgment of God has fallen on you, and other Christians writing in large numbers saying that they are praying for you. And you have to make a judgment what you're going to do about that. Now, those are not hypothetical scenarios. Those are all real scenarios. There is a professor of a well-known university who is an expert in Africanology, and he is a voodoo priest. The burning of the Quran did happen a couple of weeks ago in Florida, and there were mobs in Afghanistan. And Christopher Hitchens, a well-known author and passionate atheist, writing books like God Is Not Great, did develop cancer and did receive volumes of letters, some of them condemning him and many others offering prayers. This is the man, by the way, who decided to write a book on the life of Mother Teresa just to prove how unholy she is. There is a virtual universal search for God in the human race. And the question of the day is, how many ways are there to God? First question, do all paths lead to the same place? Unless we think that Oprah Winfrey was the person who invented this question, she was not. You can go back thousands of years to what is the oldest organized religion in the world, Hinduism. And its basic teachings for millennia that, in fact, there are many, many different paths to deity. And Brahman is so complex and so big, it's hard to describe that reality either as an absolute being or as many beings or as a being that pervades the universe. And, in fact, there is no reason whatsoever to reject any religions in the world, because basically everything is moving down different paths toward the same goal. Do all paths lead to the same place? That's one question. The next question is the question of God personal and subjective, or universal and objective? For some people, they assume that when you talk about God, you're talking about a real being. There is an objectivity there. We're not talking about an idea. We're not talking about someone who created the universe or is at the core of a creed. You're talking about an idea that may be valid, an idea that may be completely invalid. So is the question of God personal and subjective, or universal and objective? We have a philosopher by the name of Friedrich Schleiermacher to thank for an assumption in the modern world that all of religion is subjective. It is simply a matter of feeling and sensation and experience. Schleiermacher grew up in the Moravian tradition in Europe, a tradition that had a lot of heartfelt faith to it, and so he got a pretty good dose of experiential faith. But then in his development as a thinker and a scholar and a writer and a philosopher, decided that you can have all of that feeling without there being any necessity of there being an objective and real God behind it. And what Schleiermacher put out, and he is called the father of modern Protestant theology, or the father of modern liberal Protestant theology, what he put out is that religious pluralism is the norm. All that you need to do is look all around to realize there are all kinds of religions. And in fact, in the Christian faith, there are many, many different forms of Christian faith. And to assert that there is one truth in the middle of that all, and even to believe that there is one God, an objective, true God that is in the middle of it all, is a stretch, to say the least. And so he developed a philosophy which not only asserted religious pluralism, but touted it as the best of all worlds, because religion can be a comfort to you. Now, you probably know people that they look to religion or they look to spiritual life as a comfort, but in their thinking, they don't believe as though there is any reason whatsoever for there to be any objective reality behind it. That is thanks to Friedrich Schleiermacher and many others that followed him. Now, by the way, if you do accept, if you do believe that God is subjective and purely personal, it's all a matter of feeling, then it changes the whole question. To say, are there many ways to God is really a nonsensical question, because what God are you talking about? If the whole thing is about religious feeling and religious sentiment, then you're not trying to find your way to the creator of the universe anyway, because you have no objective assumption that there is a creator of the universe. And so it really makes the whole question moot. It makes our gathering here tonight unnecessary. It changes the very fundamental question. This is an issue today, more so than ever before, because today there are so many different ways that are asserted as ways to God. The longer that human history unfolds, the more varieties of philosophy and religion are generated in the human race. And I believe that most of them are sincere attempts to find a way, if not to a real God, to a level of transcendence. And as we go on this evening, one of the things I want to emphasize is that I think it's really important to understand why people choose to believe what they do. Obviously, a lot of people hold to a certain faith just because it's what was given to them by their parents, it was a tradition that they were born into, or they assume that the people in their country are all that particular faith. But for people that have an intentional belief in that system, why do they believe it, and why do they want to believe it? And I'm going to make an assumption here tonight, by the way. I'm going to make an assumption that as we're gathered here tonight, we're a very mixed crowd. I recognize some faces here. Many of your faces I don't recognize. So just so you know, I'm making an assumption that in this room, as we have in this room tonight, we have people who have come who are believing Christians and who have an interest in this question, how many ways are there to God? Because there are people asking them that question. But I'm also assuming there are people in the room who are skeptical, or who are cynical, or who are wondering, or who had one form of faith at one time and they're not so sure anymore, or have belonged for many years to an entirely different form of faith or an entirely different religion. So I'm assuming in everything that I comment on tonight that we are a mixed crowd. Next question is this: how many different options are there? How many different options are there? In the world today, there are 2.1 million people who call themselves Christians. That's the blue piece of the pie there. There are 1.1 billion people who are Muslim. There are about 700,000 or 800,000, maybe up to a billion, it depends upon how you count, who are Hindu. There are about 400 million people who are Buddhist. And then that other part, the purple piece of the pie to the left there, that would include all kinds of other religions, local religions, and of course all of the people that don't hold to any religion or any belief system whatsoever. One thing that we need to understand is that in most of the history of the world, at most times, most religions were not monotheistic, but were polytheistic. It's an amalgam of belief in all kinds of deities, and we'll get a little bit more to that later on. So how many different options are there? There are a lot of options. The main question then, how many ways are there to God? Possible answers. What anybody says is their way to God has to be a valid way to God. That's one answer. That everybody's way is equally valid as anybody else's. Another answer to the question, how many ways are there to God, is that there are many ways. Nobody can count them exactly, but human beings have from time immemorial tried to find their way to God, find their way to a creator, find their way to transcendence, and there's no reason to think that any of those options are better than another. Another answer to the question is that there are some ways to God. There are some forms of faith or religion that are more valid than others. Another possible answer to the question is that there is one way to God. And I'm leaving off one option as to how many ways are there to God. Anybody think about what I'm leaving off? There are no ways to God. One of the things I found interesting is I talked to people about this talk, and I ask them the question, how many different alternatives are there in answering that question? And people will say, well, there are many ways to God. There's one way to God. There's a handful of ways to God. We always forget that there are vast numbers of people out there who believe that there is no way to God. They think there probably is a God, but they can't see how a human being in this broken world in which we live could possibly have a connection with the creator of the universe. Oftentimes because they believe as an assumption that that creator is parked away in some faraway corner of the universe and he is just simply not a knowable God. Or other people believe there are no ways to God because they've tried some and they've had a bad experience. Maybe they grew up Christian and they saw a lot of bad stuff and so they just gave it all up. How many different ways are there to God? All, many, some, one, none. One of the things that we should not say, and I'm saying this not just as a Christian, I am a Christian, but I would say the same thing if I belonged to another religion, and that is that all religions are the same. It was fashionable at one time to kind of talk like that. It never was accurate. It never was really respectful, because when you say to a Muslim or to a Hindu, or if you're a Muslim or a Hindu, you're talking to a Christian, that there is no difference between all the religions in the world, it is a fundamental expression of disrespect toward that religion, because all the religions of the world have a specific set of beliefs that they hold to. The Dalai Lama is the spiritual leader of Tibetan Buddhism, a well-known figure around the world, very affable man, very generous spirit. And a lot of times people have tried to combine Christianity and Buddhism because Buddhism is a very flexible religion. It's more a philosophy than a religion in many ways. And some have said that you can take Christian belief in Jesus and layer on it some of the features of Buddhism, which includes transcendence and meditation and all the rest. The Dalai Lama said this of such attempts. He said, trying to combine Christianity with Buddhism is like putting a yak's head on a sheep's body. And if you don't know what that looks like, maybe it looks something like that. What did he mean by that? What he meant by that is, it makes no sense whatsoever to take one belief system and then an entirely different belief system and say the thing that we really want to do is just kind of combine these into some kind of a stew, because they are fundamentally incompatible. And you're not saying anything disrespectful by saying people that belong to a different faith system or a different religion are believing something that is fundamentally different. Not at every point necessarily. There are some issues where most of the religions in the world hold common ground, and we'll get to that in a little bit. Ravi Zacharias wrote a book called Jesus Among the Gods. He was born in India. He is a eloquent writer and an expert in these matters. He says all religions are not the same. All religions do not point to God. All religions do not say that all religions are the same. At the heart of every religion is an uncompromising commitment to a particular way of defining who God is or is not. Anyone who claims that all religions are the same betrays not only an ignorance of all religions, but also a caricatured view of even the best known ones. Every religion at its core is exclusive. And what Ravi Zacharias would go on to say, talk to a Hindu, talk to a Christian, talk to a Buddhist, talk to an atheist. That's what they believe, and we shouldn't try to pretend otherwise. Now, as you know, the Christian answer to the question, how many ways are there to God, will frequently go back to a little expression of Jesus in John chapter 14, where he said, I am the way and the truth and the life. And we'll get to that a little bit later on. You can get it on a sticker. You can get it on a t-shirt. I am the way and the truth and the life. I found all kinds of pictures like this. I don't know why all of these one-way signs point to the east, whether that's to Philadelphia or to India or whatever it is. You know, I've been out east. I don't need to go out east. So I hope that Jesus is bringing me someplace better than than Philadelphia. How many different ways are there to God? Let me say this too about the question. We are not going to limit ourselves tonight and what we're talking about to how many ways are there to heaven. That is one pressing question that people have. What's going to happen to me when I die? And if there is a place of bliss and blessedness, I want to go there. How do I get there? We're asking a broader question. How many ways are there to God? We're not even talking tonight about how many ways are there to salvation. As important as salvation is, what we're talking about is right here and now, from wherever you are or wherever I am in our lives right now, what has to happen next for us to close the gap with God? And from a Christian point of view, that is the ultimate answer to the question of heaven. The answer of heaven is not you do this and this in order to get to heaven, because heaven is an extension of a relationship with God in this life. In fact, anybody who believes I'm just going to live the way that I want to in this life, and if I do this and this, I've got a ticket to heaven. There's a fundamental misunderstanding from a Christian point of view of what it means to go to heaven, because it's all about finding your way to God right now, closing the gap with God right now. And heaven means God saying, those who want to be with me now, I want them to be with me forever. So don't think narrowly about this question. How many ways are there to God? Another way of answering the question is that there are many ways. I will tell you tonight, there are many ways to God. The question is, how many ways work? If there is an objective reality to God, if God is a real being and he created the universe, and he is a benevolent God. He loves the world that he created. He even loves the human race, as stinky as our behavior can be. If there is that kind of God who objectively exists, there are all kinds of people that over millennia have attempted ways to get to God. And the Bible teaches that there are many attempts that people have made in a purely natural sense to make progress toward that deity. The question, however, is what is the way that is really going to close that gap? That's what we're going to try to answer. Let's talk about the search for a way. What are these different ways that have been attempted? There were some people who thought, like the German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche, that religion in the modern world was going to become passé. Just human beings were going to grow out of it. They would come to realize that superstition is for children, and that with the passage of time, you would see human beings become less and less religious, less and less spiritual. Guess what? It didn't happen. Nietzsche said that many generations ago, but in fact, the human race is today as spiritual as it has ever been, and that is because God made human beings to be spiritual creatures. I read an article today of a study that was done really just a couple of weeks ago. Some sociologists and mathematicians got together, and they predicted that in 9 countries of the world, religion would become extinct within a matter of years. And those countries, I wish I could remember because you're going to want to know, it included the Czech Republic, and it included Canada. I was surprised about that, and maybe we shouldn't be surprised about that. 9 different countries in which they said the trend line, mathematically speaking, in terms of religious affiliation, in terms of people saying, I belong to this group or to that group, is just going down and down and down. And if you plot it out mathematically, you're talking about a situation where religion will become extinct. Well, Ed Stetzer, who just came out this week with an article, I was thrilled to find this because it's very apropos for what we're doing tonight, an article called Proselytizing in a Multi-Faith World. I'll allude to it a little bit more later on. He says, and he's a researcher, that in the year 1900, 67% of the world's population adhered to the 4 major religions: Christianity, Islam, Hinduism, and Buddhism. 67%. Today, it's 75%. And calculations are that by 2025, 80% of the world's population will call themselves Christian, Muslim, Hindu, or Buddhism. Nietzsche was wrong. A number of years ago, when he was still alive, ABC's news manager, Peter Jennings, decided that there's no way that you can report on the news without having an understanding of religion. And for a long time, news media in the U.S. had decided religion is a subjective category. We're not even going to touch that. But you know, it's only been in the last 20 or 30 years that news organizations have said, we have to have an expert on religion because you can't ignore it as a major phenomenon in the world today and in our country for sure. There is, in fact, a near universal drive to find God, or at least a principle of transcendence. A medieval thinker by the name of Anselm talked about this centuries ago when he said that when you look at human experience, almost everybody has an innate sense that there is a God. It is by far the exception to the rule rather than the rule that people believe in the existence of God. And Anselm went on to say that that very fact, that human beings almost universally have a sense that there is a God, is in and of itself a proof for the existence of God, because Anselm said, how could you explain the very idea of a God unless that God really did exist? Sometimes called the ontological argument for the existence of God, because it's based in the being of what a person is. But then in the Old Testament, in the Hebrew Scriptures, in Ecclesiastes 3:11, it says, God has made everything beautiful in its time. He's also set eternity in the hearts of men. That there is in the human heart this assumption of something beyond the created. Augustine said, our hearts are restless until they find their rest in God. And I am interested in figuring out why different people choose to believe that they do. And so to that end, let's just take a quick skip through some of the major religions of the world, the major alternatives. First of all, Hinduism. Many religions, one river might be one way of describing it. The word Hindu comes from the Indus River, and the idea of a river being a flow contributed to by multiple tributaries is very much in line with this ancient form of religion, which says there are many different streams feeding into belief in God. And in fact, if you want to understand true belief in God, you are going to look at that pluralism. Pluralism is not a problem. Pluralism is the reality. It is a fundamental characteristic of it. Hinduism is a system that to Westerners is very hard to understand. There's a lot of apparent contradictions and mystery to it, because you can look at it as a monotheistic religion because there is Brahman, but then again, Brahman isn't exactly God. There are all kinds of manifestations of Brahman in different deities, numbering perhaps in the millions. And then there's another stream of Hinduism that is pantheistic, that believes that God has pervaded, deity has pervaded all things physical. And you have all of those streams there. And in Hinduism, that is viewed simply as the way that it is, that our religious understanding is this blend of many different things. There are sacred scriptures in Hinduism that come across a wide range, across a wide period of time. But at its core is belief in Dharma, which is an ethic of life, and samsara, which is rebirth, the cycle of reincarnation, karma, in which the deeds that you do in this life have an effect upon what happens after this life. And then there's also the hope of liberation from the cycle of reincarnation. In the Hindu pantheon, there are many, many different deities, all playing into the idea of one universal deity, Brahman, and you, the human subject, Atman, desires to become one with that Brahman. A variation on Hinduism, or a derivation of it, was a religious movement started hundreds of years before Christ, when in the northeast of India, one Gautama Siddhartha, as a young man, set out on a quest to find truth. And it's a long story, but to make a long story short, what he settled on was a philosophy of life that it was in some ways a reaction against Christ. Hinduism, of what he saw as some of the dead-end streets in Hinduism, some of the unsatisfactory characteristics of Hinduism. And Buddhism settles on a view of life, excuse me, in which meditation is a practice in which you as a finite being become connected with the transcendent. In many ways, Buddhism is a practice more than a faith. In many ways, Buddhism is a philosophy more than a religion, because in Buddhism, there is no God, or it just doesn't matter that there is a God. It really is about a whole way of life. And the goal in life through meditation is that you reach a state of enlightenment, and then you get beyond the thing that really holds you back, which is the perception of suffering in your life. Suffering is a reality, but we only perceive there to be suffering because we have so many longings or so many desires. And so through the practices of Buddhism, you give up your desires, you give up your longings, and when you do that, then suffering becomes to you a non-real thing, and you don't need to worry about it so much anymore. That's the tenets of Buddhism, and it has been very popular in different parts of the world. Many different forms of Buddhism, but it is at its core a practice and a philosophical system. If you meet the Buddha on the road, kill him is a famous expression. What that means is that the Buddha said that any person can reach nirvana, can become as much Buddha as anybody else. If anybody stands up and says, I am the leader of the religion, then get rid of them, because there is no one person who should ever say that he or she is the leader of the religion. Buddhism emphasizes enlightenment. And in Christian faith, we talk about enlightenment too. Jesus talked about, I am the light of the world, he who believes in me, if you obey my commands. But it's not a light that comes from within, it's a light that comes from without. It's a light that shines into our lives and we realize our way to God. Then there's Islam. We all became familiar with Islam a few decades back in the Iran hostage crisis, and all of a sudden the phenomenon of Islam became a concern for everybody. Islam is a very different thing. It is it was founded in the 600s by Muhammad in Arabia, a place that was very wild and very unruly and very tribal. There were many different religions, many different options, including Christianity and including Judaism. Interestingly enough, Muhammad had interaction with Christians at that time and was kind of curious about Christianity. The only problem is the Christians that he met and got to know were so completely clueless about the meaning of the Bible, they grossly misrepresented it to him, and he didn't want to have anything to do with it. But Islam believes that Muhammad was given a revelation by God, by Allah, and that in that revelation, God poured out his truth in a direct way, in a manner of dictation. The Quran today is, in fact, the direct dictation of God. There is a simplicity to Islam, and for many people, that is a part of its attraction. There's not much supernatural element to it. It's about practice, and those practices are few. They are the pillars of the faith, like declaring your faith. There is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet. You say that, and you become a Muslim. It's nothing more complicated than that. Praying toward the east, charity, fasting, and a once-in-a-life pilgrimage to Mecca. As I already mentioned, at the center of Islam is the holy book, the Quran. And what Muslims believe is that Muhammad received a direct revelation. He didn't write the Quran. He was simply the typing machine through which the Quran came. And that book is extremely holy. It is, in some ways, the miracle of Islam. There aren't other miracles in the belief system. The one miracle is this divinely inspired book. In fact, the Quran cannot be officially translated into other languages because its only true form is God's language, which is Arabic, the form in which it was originally given. And this gives us some insight, by the way, into the global reactions to the burning of the Quran, because it's not analogous to a Christian Bible being burned. It's more analogous to Jesus being crucified again. Because while Jews and Christians believe that the scriptures were given through the inspiration of God, through the instrumentality of prophets and apostles, the Quran is believed to be the very breath, the very word of Allah. No human agency whatsoever. It is an incarnate reality. And so when the pastor in Florida says, we are going to put the Quran on trial, that to Muslims sounds like it would to Christians, we are going to crucify Jesus again. Something very, very different, the earth religions, neo-pagan religions, which are more ancient than anything else. They are earth religions. They are tied into worship of the earth, Wicca and Druidism and other things. A very small number of people holding to those religions. And you say, what is the attraction of this? The attraction is simple. It's primitive. It's primal. It's about power. It's about independence. It's a non-creedal form of religion. The only creed in Wicca and other neo-pagan religions is don't do harm to others. It's a kind of a derivation of the golden rule, do unto others as you would have them do unto you, a much more primitive version of it. Just don't do bad things to other people. That's the whole creed. That's the whole belief system. But there are people, there are young people who they're just ordinary folks, and they are looking for some sense of identity, some sense of power, some sense of independence, something primal, something ancient, something earthy, and maybe the earth itself, the greatest reality that we experience, isn't just a bunch of water and land mass. Maybe it is deity. Maybe it's Gaia, as the people who built Stonehenge believed. Atheism is another challenge. It is a non-belief in God, but to be an atheist requires a lot of talking about God. And there are different forms of atheism. Positive atheism says, there is a God. We know there is no God. Wake up to the reality that there is no God. Then there's practical atheism, a very widespread phenomenon where people don't say, I'm an atheist, but because they live with no apparent interest in or connection to the Creator whatsoever, practically speaking, they are living as atheists. And agnosticism says, we just don't know. Christianity is a religion that has a physical manifestation in the history and in the different traditions and in the different churches and the denominations and so on. But at its heart, Christianity is about Jesus. And today, with so many cynical feelings about religion in the world today, there's an amazing interest in people to, what if we just kind of set aside Christianity? Not to condemn it, but it is a mixed bag. And brought ourselves right back to Jesus, to a core belief in Jesus the Christ. And when you do that, you do come back to the statement that Jesus said in John chapter 14, I am the way and the truth and the life. But here's a question for you. What did he mean by that? I am the way. How many different ways are there to God? Jesus says, I am the way. He wasn't just talking about heaven. He wasn't talking about a organized religion. He was talking about something very, very dynamic. And to get at that question, we have to look at what the word way or the concept of way is in the Old Testament and in the New Testament. A way is a road. And so that's why Eugene Peterson's a translation called The Message has Jesus saying this, I am the road. It's how you get from here to here. Thank you. A little bit froggy up here. It's how you close the gap with God. It is a way. And in our consciousness, in our poetry, in our stories, we are very, very familiar with different ways. But the ways, the roads of the ancient Near East look different than our roads today. They're not paved. As a matter of fact, this is an extremely modern version of a road, a pathway in Judea. This is also a road in Judea. It's simply a footpath. It's not systematic. It's not groomed. It's not paved. It is simply a reliable way that you get from one place to the next. Because if you live in the ancient Near East, it can be treacherous getting from point A to point B. If you go to Masada down near the Dead Sea to get up to the top of that fortress that Herod the Great built, you need to know the way to get there. And in fact, the way up to the top of Masada is that little zigzag path that you see there. It's called the snake path, and it's a road. It's a way that you get to the top of that place without falling off the edge. When Jesus talked about I am the way, he was talking in a context like the Judean wilderness here, where if you didn't follow a reliable path, you could be in danger, as was the case in his parable of the Good Samaritan. A man was walking from Jericho to Jerusalem, and that set of hills and valleys and wadis. Wadis are valleys where the rainwater comes rushing through and then they dry up. That's how you get from Jerusalem over to Jericho. But there's dangers throughout it all. And in the parable of the Good Samaritan, Jesus talks about thieves hiding around the side of a hill. Happened all of the time in that particular context. Now, Moses followed a way. When God summoned Moses, we know that Moses was a mountain climber, right? And when he went up Mount Sinai, he was the best mountain climber of his day. And he was in all of the newspapers and in all of the magazines. He summited Mount Sinai, and he put his flag there, and he raised his fist to the heavens. No. It's interesting that today, when we talk about our accomplishments, like leadership accomplishments and that, we use the metaphor of summiting a mountain. And what we are able to do, when God summoned Moses to him and said, come up here so I can talk to you on Mount Sinai, it looked a whole lot more like that. The wilderness there is rocky, it's hilly, it's uncertain. You need a reliable path. I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father but by me. Quite a number of years ago, my wife and I were hiking in the highlands of Scotland, and we were in a beautiful place called Glen Nevis, and there was a small mountain there called Ben Nevis, and we decided to take a walk, and I made the mistake of assuming that there's just many different ways you can get to the top of Glen Nevis. I mean, if you just keep going up, if you keep raising your altitude, you're going to get to the top, right? It's not necessarily so when you're climbing a mountain. There is a way to get to the top, and there is all kinds of ways of making an attempt to get to the top, but you never, ever do make it to the top. I also found this with some degree of embarrassment when we tried to get down. It's not necessarily easy to get down a mountain unless you're following a way, a reliable way. And that, I think, is a little bit the way that it is in the world of faith and belief and religion. The question is not how many ways are there to God. The question is how many ways are there that actually work? How many ways are there that work? I am interested in learning from the people that I know who are Hindu or Muslim or Buddhist or who adhere to Wicca, or I'm interested in knowing what is it that you're looking for. Because I'm a believing Christian, but what I find more often than not is that the spiritual need, the thing that the person is looking for, is something that I am looking for too. In fact, it is something that Christianity and Jesus holds forth. It's just that it doesn't get you all the way to the top of the mountain. And then there is this. If you don't remember anything else tonight, remember this. If there is a transcendent God who created the heavens and the earth, who created the universe, and if we in the human race are so mixed up and so confused and we have so many things going on, isn't it likely that you and I will never, ever, ever find a way to the top? that in fact, that transcending God would need to come to us and say to us, I am the way. Not let me show you a way. Not let me show you a better path. Not you're doing pretty well. Let me just give you a couple of hints along the way. But a transcending God who comes to us and says, listen, there is no way that you will ever make your way to me. That was tried in the book of Genesis with a construction project known as the Tower of Babel. Let us construct a tower that will reach to heaven. And instead, in the Hebrew scriptures, the idea is God saying to the human race, you don't need that. What you need is for me to come to you and to close the gap with you. God reveals himself. I am the way and the truth and the life. Now, for anybody that is concerned that the so-called exclusivism of Christianity is a problem, let me just point this out. There's a difference between being exclusive and excluding. There is a difference between being exclusive and being excluding. If, in Christian faith, there is a Savior who's come who was uniquely the Son of God, who existed with God before all time but became a human being and who was born of a virgin and who lived a perfect life, something that Muhammad never claimed, something that Buddha never claimed, but Jesus claimed to have a perfect life, then when he says, I am the way, it is not in order to exclude anybody, but as a way of reaching out to everybody. And so back to the original question, when Christians say there is one way to God and Jesus is that way, is it mean-spirited? No. Is it excluding? No. It's exclusive in the sense of a belief, going back to Jesus himself, that there is a way to God and only God himself knows it and makes it available to us. I'm going to read something that I wrote a few years ago that maybe will express this best. When someone says to me, do you believe that Jesus is the only way to God? My response is something like this. I believe that Jesus is the way to God. I believe that Jesus did something utterly unique in the human race and for the human race. He died a death that was not merely martyrdom, but atonement, the payment for the penalty of my sin. No one else has ever claimed to do that. The reason why the value of his death rises so far beyond martyrdom is because of who he is. I believe that Jesus is the Son of God, co-creator of the world with God the Father, and that he existed before he came into the world in the family of a carpenter 2,000 years ago. I believe that human beings should have solved the problem of their guilt, but only God could. That explains why the Son of God became a real person. Only God could provide the forgiving grace, and only God can change me from the inside out. Therefore, I believe that Jesus is, as he himself said, the way to God. And because what he did was so completely unique in all of human history, yes, he is the only way to God. I don't believe this in order to exclude anybody, but because my heart and mind have been taken captive by the love and power of God shown so convincingly in Christ's great work of rescue. And I'm thrilled that Jesus himself extended his mercy and truth to anybody and everybody in the world. I will pass on the message of Jesus to anybody I can, because to do otherwise would only be selfishness on my part. And as someone receives this message and experiences for the first time in life the spiritual freedom that comes through Jesus, then that is not to my credit. In fact, it has nothing to do with me. Even if I have transmitted the message, it is about one of God's beloved children making his or her way home. Let's use a comparison here. Imagine you are at work in your office in a modern skyscraper. Suddenly the building is filled with smoke from a fire in some unseen part of the building. Though you thought you knew this building well, in the dense smoke you are disoriented and you wander about for an exit, bumping into furniture and walls. Just then a figure emerges from the smoke, wearing heavy, dark clothing with fluorescent yellow stripes. By the boots and helmet and that tank on his back, you recognize him as a fireman. With an axe in one hand and a flashlight beaming from his helmet, he holds out his hands to you and shouts, "Let me get you out of here." Now at that moment, the most important reality of your life is that your rescuer has come. because of who he is and what he is able to do. He knows far better than you how to get out of that building. So you don't stand there and debate whether there are other ways out of the building. You just follow him. You follow as closely as you can, not letting those fluorescent yellow stripes out of your sight for a moment. And he does get you out. Christians believe that Jesus Christ is, as John the Baptist said, the Lamb of the world who takes away the sin of the world, which is another way of saying that he made it possible for us to be truly and fully forgiven. He is not a Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. He is not one of the Lambs of God who takes away the sin of the world. He is the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. The Bible says that God designed this rescue plan long before we were born or had our first major failure in life. It is up to us whether we look at God and say, "Thank you, I believe," or "I dare not believe that absolutely because it may appear that I'm saying that somebody else is wrong." This is not a philosophical debate over who can say they're right and who can say they're wrong. It's about rescue. The world is burning. We're all living in this world. There are some days that are clear and bright, and other days when we feel like we're groping our way through smoke-filled hallways. What did Jesus mean when he said, "I am the way"? Isn't it simply this? Follow me, and you will be safe. Follow me, and you will be healthy. Follow me, and you will find God and find yourself, the true self God designed you to be. All right, we're going to leave it at that because I've got a very specific time goal in mind. And at this point, I want to entertain questions that you may have about anything that we've been talking about here. Anything along the lines of the question of how many ways are there to God and how do you know this and how do you know that and how do you know the other? And we have a special guest with us. I thought that instead of you just listening to me again, I tap the shoulder of one of my friends. He is author Mark Middleburg, who is the author of Becoming a Contagious Christian, also the author of The Reason Why, and also the author of, I'll tell you in a few minutes, Choosing Your Faith in a World of Spiritual Options and Other Things. I'll tell you more at the end. Mark is joining us via video Skype from his home in Colorado. Mark, can you hear me okay?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Sure can.
This is cool.
It is cool. Let's just talk for a little while, Mark. This is just too cool. All right. No, we have some good people here who may have some questions. And while they're thinking about those questions, let me just ask you a little bit. What is your angle on all of this? You spend your time talking about religious alternatives and faith alternatives and how we sort all of that stuff out. Tell us a little bit about your own work.
Well, one thing I've done over the years is studied what the particular religions actually teach. And, you know, it's so easy for people to say they all teach the same thing, they all have the same God, and they just use different names for him. And as I've studied various religions, I've seen great differences in what they teach, even about the nature of God himself. And forgive me, I didn't get to hear your whole talk, so if I'm repeating something that you've already said, then you just do the timeout and tell me. But for instance, you talk to Buddhists, and if they're Theravedic Buddhists, the kind of the original historic Buddhists, they believe what the Buddha himself taught, and that is that there probably was no God or is no God. They're at best agnostic, if not atheistic. A lot of people don't know that, but at least in the purest form of Buddhism, the historic form, they're atheistic or agnostic. You go to Hindus and they believe everything is God. You go to, a Christian and they believe there's a God who created all things and he made everything, but he's not part of everything. So one thing I think is important to realize is we're not trying to exclude other ones that kind of say the same thing, but say it in a different way. They say fundamentally different things. And even when you come to, monotheistic religions like Islam, they say the same thing in terms of there being only one true God. But then when it comes to Jesus, they say he was not the Son of God. He never claimed to be the Son of God. God has no son. And furthermore, Jesus did not die on the cross. because God would never allow one of his prophets to die in such a way. Therefore, the resurrection is false. Therefore, you can cancel your Easter services. So these are, you know, huge differences in what is taught. And I think it's important for us to realize that we're not kind of saying the same thing.
Okay, thanks, Mark. Thanks for getting us going. Who would like to throw out a question, either to me or to Mark? Mark gets the difficult questions. And by the way, you can wave to Mark. He's right up there.
My question is, in this country that we live in here, some of these religions that you spoke of exist, but one of the things that I have run into in my own life is other pseudo-Christian faiths such as Mormonism and Jehovah's Witnesses, and how does Christianity compare to them or differ from their religions?
Thank you, Mark. Thank you for the question. Mark, would you take a stab at that?
Sure. There again, I think it's very similar to what we just said, that a lot of people, especially in the case of Mormonism, I think there are great attempts by the Mormon Church, the Latter-day Saints, to portray themselves as just another denomination, that, you know, there's been a lot of misunderstanding in the past, but we really all more or less believe the same things. And that is simply just not true. It's not true historically. It's not true now. Mormonism, the more you study it, the more you realize how distant it is from the teachings of the Bible and the teachings of Christianity. And I'm not dissing anyone's, you know, personality or anyone individually. I'm just saying their teachings deny, in fact, the most fundamental difference is that they believe there are many gods, and that literally our God, the God of this world, had a father and mother God, and that father and mother God had grandparent gods, and that you as a male could become a Mormon and become a god. And that is basic Mormon teaching. And so you compare that to what the Bible teaches, which is strictly, the Bible is strictly a monotheistic teaching. And in that sense, we're closer to Islam than we are to Mormonism. And then you go to Jehovah's Witnesses, they believe in one God, but then they deny the deity of Christ. They make Jesus a created being. And so they, you know, the fundamental identity of who Jesus is, which cuts right to the heart of the gospel, is denied by them. So even though they seem like maybe they're closer and they're kind of offshoots of Orthodox Christianity, there are vast differences with these groups.
Thank you, Mark. And I think just one other thing I would add is that it should come as no surprise that if there is a belief system as intricate and as deep and as wide as the Christian faith based upon the Hebrew tradition, that there are going to be experiments, there are going to be derivations, there are going to be spin-offs. You can use the word cult, you can use the word sect sometimes, and all of that is just a part of the way things unfold in history. Another question. Yes, right over here.
We have friends that are Muslim, and they many times refer to people, Christians, Jews, and Muslims, being people of the book. And they recognize Jesus as the last and greatest prophet before Muhammad. But what I found interesting is that when the end of the world comes, unlike Iran with the 12th Imam, that Jesus will be the one coming back at the end of time to the Muslim religion. I'm just curious about that. It just seems like a difference. I'd like an understanding.
You got anything to say about that, Mark?
Yeah, it's interesting that they do keep intact certain things that are biblical teachings about Jesus returning, that he is Messiah, that he is sinless. Muhammad never claimed to be sinless. There are certainly elements of truth that have been retained in Islam. But again, when you cut to the core, one of the verses that always challenges me, I think it's sort of a sobering verse, is John 8:24, where Jesus said, "Unless you believe that I am who I claim to be, you will die in your sins." Jesus made it very clear that accepting him and his claims to divinity, his identity as the Son of God, which meant the one who shared the nature of the Father, he pinned our very salvation to that. And so, I mean, again, those are strong words from Jesus, but very clear that embracing him as leader, you know, when a Muslim says they accept him as a prophet, what I say is that's great, but if you really accept him as a prophet, you have to accept what he prophesied. Or if you say he's a good teacher, and this would be true for a lot of other people besides Muslims, a lot of Jewish people will say, well, I don't believe he's the Messiah, but he was a good teacher. And I just say, well, then we've got to listen to what he taught, because he taught that he was the Messiah, that he was the Son of God, that he was the one who came to give himself as a sacrifice for us. And so kind of my basic plea over and over is to let Jesus speak for himself.
Thanks, Mark. Another question. Phil.
Just taking the seat of a seeker's advocate for once. Let's say I accept the reality or the truth that all these religions don't teach the same thing. I acknowledge that Jesus said this or that. How do I go about figuring out if he really is truth or if he was a lunatic?
Using that word recalls the famous quote of C.S. Lewis, who said that if you read what is said in the Gospels by Jesus, the claims, the extraordinary, the expansive claims of Jesus, you have to figure out he was off his rocker, he was a lunatic, or he was just wicked. I mean, he was misleading people to a degree that is rarely, if ever, seen. Or what he said was true. And then Lewis went on to say, but whatever you do, don't put forward this nonsense that he was a great moral teacher. That's like saying nothing. Because Jesus' teachings were moral. There's ethics in there. There's intriguing principles of life. But it is so much more than that. His claim of forgiving sin, his claim of being one with God, his claim of having authority to say what is true or not. Lewis said he did not leave open the option of him being called simply a moral teacher. Something else you want to say about that, Mark?
Well, yeah, I think if you go back to Lewis and read what he said, he also did a good job of demonstrating that Jesus didn't in any way act like a crazy person or a deceiver, a lunatic or a liar. That the evidence shows that he was very sound, that he confounded the wise teachers of his age. They couldn't silence him. They, you know, these guys followed him around for years looking for anything he would say that would be untrue or unsound, or, you know, if he was saying crazy things, they would have had plenty to go after him with. But when it really came down to the end, when Jesus was on trial, you read the accounts, they were searching around, making up stuff. They were paying false witnesses to come in and, you know, tell stories and tell tales about Jesus, because his life was so consistent and so pure and, you know, sinless and so much lived up to his claims to being the divine Son of God and the Messiah, not to mention that he fulfilled prophecies and did miracles. And then after they crucified him, he rose from the dead. I think Jesus left a pretty airtight case showing that he was neither crazy nor dishonest. And if he was dishonest, I mean, it was going against everything he taught and everything he seemed to live. So I think it would take more faith to believe Jesus was a lunatic or a liar than to believe he's Lord.
Okay, while the next person is thinking of a question, and I'm waiting. Okay, just one second. Just before we come to you, before I forget it, I mentioned quickly in passing this article in Christianity Today that just came out called Proselytizing in a Multi-Faith World. And the author, who is a researcher by the name of Ed Stetzer, he talks about being in a meeting of people of all different faiths, all different religions, and they were talking about how to get along. And he said what was really interesting is that in this particular meeting, what came out in the discussion was, A, everybody in the room knows we don't believe the same things. We believe dramatically different things. And what also came out in the discussion, as he relates it, is that most of the people in the room were interested in converting other people in the room, in principle. Not the Hindu in the room. I mean, you know, it's just conversion just is not, generally speaking, proselytism is proselytizing is not generally the approach. But Stetzer raises the point in this article. He says, A, to get along in the world is not achieved by saying there's no differences between the religions. What the way you get along is by recognizing them and then having respectful and civil discussions about what you believe. And I've had friends tell me, you know, when you go to other parts of the world, people have very open, very frank discussions of their religious or spiritual ideas and their differences. And they're not afraid of it like you are in America. And Stetzer goes beyond that and says, in fact, we need to acknowledge that most of the major religions in the world are, in fact, evangelistic. They are, in fact, missional. They have a truth that they want to spread. And so what he says is, give up the idea of interfaith. In fact, what we need to think of is multi-faith, that we live in a world in which you have multiple faiths and you need to approach it in that way. Okay, question up in the balcony. Thank you.
Thanks. Actually, that's a perfect segue into what I was asking. I have a few friends that are new to the States, and they are from India, and they're Hindu. They're in their early 20s, and just having some dialogue with them. Pardon me. My question is, what would be some good conversation starters if you're talking about becoming a contagious Christian? I want to maintain that respect. But what are, from their perspective, what would challenge them?
Well, I'll give you a real short answer to that question, and then I'll let Mark answer.
Thanks.
I think the best thing to do is to be interested in what other people are thinking. Ask questions. I mean, I think that if you are, let's say you're a Christian and you have a long-standing and deep commitment to faith in Christ, you have good reason to be curious about the spiritual longings and beliefs and belief systems of other people. And you always show respect and you build a bridge to people when you show an interest in them and ask them to tell you what they believe and why they want to believe it. What would you add, Mark?
Well, I was going to say the same thing. I totally agree. And I think what we have to do is bite our tongues, because it's so tempting as soon as they say, well, we believe everything is God, or we believe in many gods. You know, you don't want to start shaking your head saying, well, that's idolatry. And I mean, you want to just, as you said, be respectful. 1 Peter 3:15 tells us to give an answer to everyone who asks for the reason for the hope that we have, but to do it with gentleness and respect. So I totally agree with that, to ask lots of questions. And in so doing, they're going to naturally at some point reciprocate and say, well, what do you believe? And, you know, tell us about it. The only other thing I would add would be, I always try to center back on Jesus, because it's easy to just stay kind of broad, you know, practices, and, you know, you go to the temple, we go to the church, or you worship on certain days and we do, you know, other days, and versus saying, let's get to what the real central deal is here. And, you know, we're, as Christians, that means we're followers of Christ. Have you ever looked into Jesus? Have you ever looked at, I mean, the reason I follow him is he had credentials. He, as I said earlier, he's the guy that did miracles. He's the guy that fulfilled prophecies written hundreds of years before he came. He's the one who rose from the dead. He's the one who taught in ways that no one could refute and lived a life to back it up. And so I think he's a guy who, unlike anyone that's ever walked the planet, has reasons that we ought to take him seriously and really, you know, study what he taught, because then eventually we do get to his hard teachings that he is the way, the truth, the life. And, you know, Jesus will bring them to that point, but I think we need to focus on Jesus.
I have time for one or two more questions, so who's got some good ones?
Hey, Mel?
Yes, Mark.
Well, we're getting the next one. It was funny what you were saying about proselytizing. Last time I was in New York City, the cab driver, I was in a taxi for about a half hour, and he was a Hindu, and he put in a cassette tape of a Hindu proselytizing, just basically giving arguments for Hinduism.
Yeah.
And I thought that was interesting, because you're right, they're not normally known for that.
It's not the norm, but, you know, proselytism sounds so negative, but when you think about it, what it basically comes down to is that if you have a commitment to a whole spiritual superstructure of your life and you believe it's true, it should come as no surprise that you want to pass that on to others. And one of the things that we're dealing with in the modern world is how can that common sense reality be true, and yet we get along with each other. And so,
right. Tolerance means we accept each other with different views. It doesn't mean we all think we're all right.
Right.
But let me throw in one more thing. I don't very often quote Penn from Penn and Teller, And I don't know if you've watched this clip or maybe even shown it, but, you know, he's an atheist. But there's a famous clip on YouTube where he talks about a man who gave him a Bible after one of their shows in Las Vegas, and how this guy was trying to, you know, reach out to him to proselytize him. And this guy, again, Penn is a strong atheist, but he said, you know what? He was doing the right thing. I don't, you know, in any way, disagree with him, because if he's convinced that there's a hell and I'm heading there, how much would he have to hate me not to tell me? And I thought that was so powerful. In fact, Penn said, if I knew a truck was coming and you were standing in the way, I would warn you. And if you didn't listen to my warning, I would finally tackle you. And he said, that's the way it is. If you believe that there's a hell and that people are really in trouble with God, you owe it to them. If you care about them, you must proselytize. And that's coming from an atheist. So I thought that was pretty good advice.
All right, Mark, here's a question.
Speaking of atheism, what about evolutionists? You know, my daughter is an evolutionist, and how do you tell her that, you know, it just isn't for my mind?
All right, Mark, evolution, how does that fit into what we're talking about?
Well, the first thing I try to do when that issue comes up is find out whether that is, in their mind, excludes God or not. Because there are people that believe in evolution that would say, but I believe, you know, that's kind of how God did it. Now, I don't agree with that, but I think it's far less of an issue to debate at that point. I would rather point them to Jesus again and lead them to Christ, and then with the Holy Spirit indwelling them, let them study science and see some of the problems with evolution. However, if they, in their mind, as Lee Strobel put it when he was an atheist, if they believe that evolution disproves the existence of God, or as he put it, puts God out of a job, then we've got to go after it, you know, tooth and nail. I often will point to really good books on it. I think Lee Strobel's book, The Case for a Creator, is one of the best things ever written, because he interviews a bunch of the top expert scientists on many different facets of science and how they point to a creator.
Yeah. Let me just add to that. Evolution is a very complicated topic, because it isn't that there are two views, evolution or no evolution. The type of evolution that is fundamentally contradictory to the Judeo-Christian heritage or anything that holds on to there being a God is scientific materialism.
Right.
And that is the belief, as Carl Sagan said in his book, The Cosmos. And I remember years ago there was a TV special where in this multi-evening presentation of The Cosmos, he started out with these words: the cosmos, that is the physical universe, the cosmos is all there ever was, all there is, and all there ever will be. And a chill went up my spine, because it sounded almost creedal.
It is.
Creedal. It is creedal. And what that view is that the material universe is all that there is, and so everything that happens within it needs to have a material explanation. There are other people who believe that there is a change of species and a development of species over time. It's a biological question. It's a different question. It's got nothing to do with whether or not there is a God or not, and a God who had some hand in the universe. Francis Collins, who is one of the preeminent scientists in the U.S. He mapped the human genome. He is an evangelical believer. He would be one who would count himself among, what's the word I'm looking for, Mark?
Theistic evolution.
Theistic evolution, that there is a God, and yet there is the process of evolution. Well, listen, our time has been chewed up. And Mark, we want to thank you, first of all, for joining us from Colorado. Please give Mark a welcome.
You're welcome. It's been fun.
And be safe driving home. Oh, wait a minute. You are home.
I'm sitting out looking out the woods right now.
All right. Thank you, Mark. And thank you for what you do. By the way, Mark's book is called The Questions Christians Hope No One Will Ask. We'll say goodbye to you, Mark, so we can put your book cover up on the screen.
All right.
There it is. The questions Christians Hope No One Will Ask, with answers, by Mark Middleburg. Mark's a good guy, and he's practical, and he's down to earth, and he's honest, and he's open-minded. I just want to remind you that we're going to have a session on the evening of what difference do the death and resurrection of Jesus make today. Because in worship, we celebrate the crucified and resurrected Jesus. But the question of the day, how do I really know that it makes a difference in my life and forgiveness? And how can I explain to somebody that these things that happened 2,000 years ago make a difference? We have started something brand new just on Sunday. You can join in with you want. It's a daily devotional leading up to Easter. We're doing that in partnership with BibleGateway.com. And if you go there, you can sign on. We had 6,000 people sign up on day one. And we got people from all over the world joining in a conversation about those things. Remember that the Mission Cafe is open just for you afterwards. So at least some of you got to go over there and have something. And we also have copies of this book called I Want to Believe. I wrote this a few years ago. I read it last night. There's some good stuff in here, actually. I was saying to my wife, boy, this is good. Actually, it came out of a sermon series that I did here at Elmbrook on all of the different religions in the world. It's just something that I have a passion about, and 100% of the proceeds of the book sale tonight go to some of our supporting, some of the ministry that we're doing in Latin America and China. And so there's lots of copies out there for yourself or maybe for somebody that you know. Thank you for coming. I just want to give a quick word of prayer before we leave. Lord God, we thank you that we are not alone in this universe, that there is a way that we can get to you, and that when we were unable on our own to forge a path to you, you forged a path to us. And we thank you that that is found in Jesus Christ. In his name we pray. Amen. Good night. God bless. The books are on tables right out there. Stop by the Mission Cafe. I'll be there over there in a few minutes, and we'll see you.